Blog Talk Radio.
Today on Backroom Politics, Political Perfect Storm. We recap the town hall debate and the final debate from last night. Who are the winners, who are the losers, and what happens next? Special guests today include American University political science professor and author of the book Presidential Pardon Power, Dr. Jeffrey Crouch, and author of the new political thriller In the Shade of the Mango Tree, writer David Porter. All of this and Tell Me a Story today on Backroom Politics. The final debate of the presidential season. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Joining me as they do every Tuesday, to my left in a chair that he's not used to accompanying. He might even feel a little Democratic aura around it, but he is the former Undersecretary of Commerce, longtime Senate staffer, Washington Insider, and now a very distinguished, handsome, and witty fellow. From the Simpson Center, he is the Honorable Alan Moore. Hello, Alan.
Hello, Justin. I'm doing my best here in this chair.
You're going to have to take the Democratic position. You're an Al's chair.
I can try to do that. I'll just let my mind float around into the ether and not do any serious thinking.
There we go. No facts today, obviously. To my 12 o'clock, he is the former floor chief for Gerald R. Ford, the great congressman for the great state of Michigan. He is the former vice president of government affairs for the National Broadcasting Corporation. He is the Honorable Bob Hines. Hi, Bob.
Hello, Justin. How you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. To my right, he is the former executive director of the Democratic Party of the great state of Maryland. He is longtime Washington Insider, Carl Thuban. Hello, Carl.
Hello, Justin, and my colleagues here at the table.
Very good. Lots to cover. My gosh. Debate saturation. We have the recap of last week's town hall debate as well as the recap of last night's debate. Completely different playing fields, completely different stories to tell. I just don't know where to begin. The obvious beginning point is let's go back a week and let's take a look at the town hall because that's going to lead into last night's debate, which is going to get real good coverage, I think, today with all of us here. The reality is we've got the town hall debate that happened on Thursday of last week. It was a town hall debate held at Hofstra University out in Long Island. It was an interesting format. Candy Crowley had her work cut out for her because Romney and Obama both came out swinging. In fact, I thought for sure they were going to get into headlocks and just start giving donkey punches to everybody. It was amazing. Alan Moore, start with you. The format, was it conducive to that kind of interaction between the president and Governor Romney?
Well, there was a lot of body language that was going on that included more than hand signals, but body movements, moving close, moving away, going towards the listener, and whatever. I think in reflecting on last week's debate, I hearken back to something I said 2 weeks ago, which was that the president had achieved one thing in the very first debate, and that was to greatly lower expectations for the future. What did he do a week ago? He beat expectations because he beat these very, very low expectations.
Really?
That he had created. Absolutely, because everybody thought, oh my God, if he does in the second week what he did in the first week, we're toast. So he obviously took his medication and got totally revved up, loaded for bear, and he fed his side some of the raw meat they wanted. At the same time, my feeling about Romney was he held up his end, and people can argue about who won It was not a slam dunk victory in my judgment. Maybe Obama wins on points, partly because of the change that was so apparent and obvious. But if he did win by points, he didn't win by much.
But, Carl, I mean, it was a shallow victory for the president during the town hall debate. You look at the numbers that CNN put out in their flash polls, which we're going to talk about that because that was an interesting statement that Wolf Blitzer kept putting out in their immediate polls after the debate. But in the polling numbers that CNN showed, 48% of the undecideds that viewed the debate, that actually watched the debate, felt that the president won. But when you break it down subject by subject, five out of the six subjects, whether it was the economy, a vision forward, whether it was handling jobs, it was creating jobs, it was Romney ahead by 5 points or more. Those can't be satisfying to the president or the Democrats.
Well, I think you have to look at what the president did. First of all, I said last week that he is best under pressure. He was under pressure. He had to produce, and he did. The big point is that he answered everything that Romney said, and everything that he went back and he did his homework, and every time Romney came up with something, the president answered back and fired at him, which I think is good. As far as individual points are concerned, I was happy that the president showed up and in my mind had a much, much better, don't have to get much better, but a much, much better performance they had in the first debate.
But Bob, I mean, POTUS obviously had a night and day performance, as Carl just pointed out. I mean, the president brought his, I guess at that time, would have been A-game for the debates. Just seems to me, though, that there was more attacking versus vision forward. Is that accurate, do you think?
Yeah, and I think the town hall format, Ken and both of them walking back and forth, made it more easy for them to sort of get in each other's face. So there was a lot. There was a lot, and the president, particularly, was very aggressive, and I don't blame him. He certainly wanted to show his supporters in the country that the first debate was an aberration. It was not. He wasn't on his game. He had left. He left it at home, and he was bringing it as best as he could, and he probably overbought it a little bit. But that's not to be. You would expect that to be done. And I don't begrudge him at all. I think he did a pretty damn good job. And I think, quite frankly, I think that Mr. Romney did a good job of responding to him and making the case he wanted to about the economy, particularly.
Alan Moore, did it seem almost that Mitt Romney was being almost overly aggressive at points, trying to get back one for one, hit for hit, battle for battle?
He definitely, yeah, and it's hard to separate them out. What's fresh in everybody's mind is last night,
right.
Not the week ago. So they kind of blend together. But I do believe that a week ago, Romney did show an inclination to sort of go tit for tat. And there were a few memorable exchanges, where the narrative of the moment kind of evolved a few days later, particularly on Libya and Benghazi. But I'm looking forward to letting that feed into the narrative of last night,
right?
Because I think the one contributed to the other.
Correct. But going back to the town hall debate at Hofstra, though, there were some big points that were brought out. I mean, number one, one of the criticisms of the Obama camp was that President Obama tap danced around and answered questions by attacking, which we'll get into the debate last night, but it did seem that the president did some tap dancing. Carl, you don't agree with that?
No. I think that in the town hall debate, he did what he had to do, and he made it. He did what he had to do, and I think he did it fairly well. This was a debate where he had to show the base as the vice president did the week before, that we were still in this ball game and we were fighting to get a second term. And I think that I think in that case he pushed and he did what he had to do.
Alan Moore.
I have to respond on the tap dancing issue. Every one of these debates is Dancing with the Stars. Come on, they're all tap dancing all the time. And it's okay to acknowledge that. That's part of this political game of figuring out how much to say, what not to say, how to respond this way, how aggressive to be.
Who's doing the bigger samba in the tap ball debate?
They were both dancing. And the best way to remind ourselves how much dancing has gone on in all four debates is the lack of any serious discussion by any of these guys on how big and how bad the economic situation is, the deficit crisis, and what we have to do about it. It is the elephant in the room that is not dancing. It's these guys sort of dancing around it because they're so afraid, if they get very specific, about the need to cut entitlements, the need to hold back defense, and the need to generate new revenues, that they will undercut or harm their relationship with the base. Nobody wants to take that risk. They're all dancing all the time.
Bob, you agree with Alan?
Absolutely. I think that's exactly what's going on, and you can't blame them. I mean, look, if you're a Democrat and you say, yes, we're going to have to change the entitlement programs and maybe the amounts of benefits and probably the criteria we may have to change the age on Social Security. We may have to do something about health care. If you're a Republican and you start saying, well, there's no doubt we have to raise money, we can certainly go into the tax code and clean it up, but that's not going to be enough, and I think we're going to have to raise some revenue in the form of some taxes. Now, neither party is going to say that before the election is over. Now, following the election, I am sure that the president-elect, whoever it is, will begin to just nibble a little touch around the edges and start to let people recognize that, reality being what it is, starting with the new Congress, there's going to be some real changes. And we've got my guess is the fiscal cliff will be solved by kicking it down the road a little bit, so the new administration, whoever it is, can get their feet wet before they have to dig right in. But reality is we're going to have to do some real difficult things that are, and the only way to do it is that you don't cut anybody's arm off, but everybody gets a finger nicked. You know, get a couple of digits on your little finger taken off. That's the reality of what we're going to have to do. We have no choice. Anybody who thinks we have a choice, we don't have to do that, is wrong.
But now, I mean, one of the things, though, that was noticed is the ratings on this debate. Alan Moore, 65 million people watched the town hall debate. And it was a time for, if they were going to come out and set any policy forward, that would have been the time, and hopefully many of them undecided. Did they miss the boat on that?
No, I can be critical of their caution. I can be critical of the dance that they do, but it's very, very risky at this point in the game to try to spring something new. The attack at the moment and in the immediate aftermath would be aggressive beyond belief. So I don't think they missed the boat. It just saddens me that this whole campaign, you don't suddenly get really serious in the last couple of weeks before the election, serious in a new way to talk about new stuff. But it is very disappointing that's where we are at this point in time. And let me say about those 65 million people who tuned in. It's one thing to say they turned on the debate. It's another thing to say they sat and watched it. Even some of the bloggers are writing long Z's in the middle of these debates, and
right,
they're in their tweets, because the stuff isn't that compellingly interesting for most people. First of all, most people aren't watching, and for those who do, they're not necessarily hanging on every word.
I'm impressed with how many people are watching even some of it. But in an America that's filled with what you've heard me refer to as low information voters, which is sort of the kind way to talk about them, even if they tuned it in, they're probably not going to pay close attention. They want to see the dynamic. They like to see fireworks. It's like turning on, watching a NASCAR race. It's pretty boring when the cars are just going around in a circle, but when there's a wreck or something close to a collision, then it's fun and it's
right.
Interesting. And people had reason to think something like that might be in the offing.
Bob Hines.
I think one of the reasons that the number of 65 million, I think it was, we said, almost as large as the first debate, I would venture a guess, and there's no way to know this, I guess, but I would guess that probably there were probably more folks who were tuning in to see if the president was going to get his game. You know, a lot of Democrats were pretty unhappy after the first debate, and you can understand why. And they didn't think that was the real guy. They think that can't be the guy I voted for 4 years ago. He must have had a cold, or he's sick, or his mother is ill, or something's wrong. And they tuned in to see if he was going to, you know, take it to Romney, and he did. And I think that in effect that helped them feel comfortable in their decision already made to be a Obama supporter.
Well, Carl Toobin, going back to the Hofstra debate, one of the big key takeaways was that the focus on the women's vote and the micro-targeting of Hispanic vote, very prevalent in that debate. One of the big gaffes out of Romney was the binder full of women that he got when he was governor, and that seems to have taken on a life of its own. But it seemed that there was a lot of focus on women's issues. Did President Obama do anything to help stop the hemorrhaging of the women's vote towards the Romney?
I would hope so. I think some of the polls show that he did. Other polls show that it's still close between Romney and Obama. Hopefully that debate, plus last night, will help to bring more women over to us. As we had at the beginning, the difference between the first poll that women would showed heavily Obama, and the second could have been that the first poll might have been off a little bit. It might have been much closer than people thought it would be.
When we look at the issues, a lot of the fact checkers started getting involved after the Hofstra event. Key point. One of the big sound bites that came out of the Hofstra event was the interaction between Governor Romney and President Obama on the reaction of the administration to the attack on the consul in Benghazi. Mitt Romney basically came out and said that the administration never did acknowledge the fact that it was a terrorist act. President Obama came back and said he absolutely did. It created an awkward moment almost in that interaction. Number one, Candy Crawley stepped in and interjected, Mr. President, you know, is right, but Governor Romney is also right. Did Candy Crawley do the right thing in making that statement?
It was her low point in the entire entire evening.
Really? Why?
Yeah, because she said he did say that, but of course, as we know after looking back on it for the next couple of days, he did not. He was not relating his reference to acts of terrorism that we will.
Well, folks out there on Radio Land, sorry for that little bit of dead air. We had a little bit of a connection problem with our friends at Skype. It seems we've got it rectified. But we'll make that up here later. Want to go back to the talk we were talking about before the 30 seconds of dead air we just had. Carl, is going to you about the situation with the interaction between the president and Governor Romney on the response of the administration. You seem to think that the Obama campaign had it right when they said he did acknowledge the fact that it was an act of terror and that it was, or am I misrepresenting your last comment?
No, what I said was that mistakes happen, as I use the replacement referees as examples of many mistakes that happened. And, you know, the president did say acts of terror at the press conference. Candy Crowley, unfortunately, got it wrong. And it happened, and it was a mistake, and it shouldn't have been, but it was. And then I mentioned that, you know, on last night's debate, this wasn't mentioned at all.
Looking back also at the Hofstra debate, when we talk about when we look at everything that came back as a part of it, we look at the women vote, the economy taking a high prevalence. The issue of the auto industry bailout came up, and there was a good interaction there. Who's got the advantage right now, Bob Hines, particularly in a swing state like Ohio, on the debate regarding the auto industry bailout?
Well, I think that probably the president has the advantage there, although it's probably it's more a question of union families, you know, supporting the president than anything else, and that's very appropriate. They support him, and the jobs were for the most part protected. The confusion that I think is in people's mind is that the president says that Obama didn't, you know, want to save the car industry, which is false. He did not want to save the car industry. What he wanted to do was go through what you and I were, you know, as in business or in lawyering, a regular normal bankruptcy, rather than what was done. And in a regular bankruptcy, they in effect declare bankruptcy, assets are protected, there's a refinancing, and of course the president says, well, there's no way to refinance. Well, that's neither here nor there because it's not true.
Right.
There are always ways to refinance. The point is that what the president did was basically with his team that went in there and set the system up, they basically gave the union a whole lot of control of the company.
Right.
Now that's okay if that's what he wants. It's a legitimate decision on the part of the president. But to say that Mr. Romney didn't care about GE and its workers is not accurate.
Carl Tooman.
First of all, I want to make – you said Obama when you met Romney in that
right.
Situation.
Oh, right, right.
Oh, thank you.
That's number one. Number two –
Thank you. A good Democrat being an honest
wow,
man helping me
go.
Out.
Number two – and I can't quite remember the whole situation around that time, but, you know, banks were not lending. People were not investing. And the president said basically he had to do it because nobody else was coming in with money to help. I'm not sure whether that's completely accurate or not. I have to say that. So, therefore, he felt that it was incumbent upon the government to step in and do what they did. And luckily, it all worked out. And as he said, instead of buying cars from China, we're now sending cars to China to be sold by GM.
Alan Moore.
Carl is absolutely right about the quote. But I thought, what cars?
Have you not seen the Panda? My God, it's a great car.
How about, first of all, there are Fords. Toyotas, Nissans,
BMWs, Mercedes,
and Porsches that are all made in America. But it's also the case that there were always going to be some GM cars and some Chrysler cars. Governor Romney has done a poor job of explaining what he wanted to do, partly because he didn't take the time to educate people or remind people what bankruptcy means. Bankruptcy doesn't mean you shut the door and liquidate everything.
Right.
What bankruptcy means is, as Bob said, you protect assets and figure out who will come in and buy what assets and run what things.
Well, hold that thought, because we're coming up with a break right now.
Okay.
When we come back from the break, that would be a good lead off for our discussion for last night, because, again, auto industry, even though it was a foreign affairs debate, auto industry came back into play late in the debate, and it spiked everywhere. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We will be back in 2 minutes. Stay with us.
Wow, a little bit of Fats Waller. Lulu back in town. And I tell you, when I am back in town, or when any of my friends are back in town, or heck, when we're living here in town, we usually find ourselves down at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., right across from the National Press Club. Why do we come here? Well, they've got the city's best cigar menu, the most diversified, with some of the best-known brands and some that you might even know, but you might want to give it a try. Everything from Arturo Fuentes down to Zeno. You can go all the way from your $9 little petite girly flavored cigars all the way up to the Opus X Lost City. They have a cigar for everybody. Mild, medium, strong, heavy. However you want to smoke it, it's available here at Shelley's Back Room. Come in, have Bob, Na, or any one of the girls show you what the right cigar might be for your taste that evening. Again, Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. As Bob likes to put it, it is definitely the place to be.
You can tell the mailman not to call. I ain't coming home until the fall. And again, I might not get back home at all. Lulu's back in town, yeah.
Going to be talking about the presidential debate last night now, and also where does the presidential race go from here? Alan Moore, last night we were talking about the car industry before the break. The car industry, even though it was a foreign affairs debate, they still talked about the auto bailout. I want to continue down that path because one of the things that we see or we hear is that Governor Romney wanted Detroit to basically go under, according to the Democrats. He would have liquidated all of Detroit. The other side of the House says absolutely not. He's basically taken the same ideal and practice that Lee Iacocca did back in the 80s, and Chrysler came back stronger than ever. Is that accurate?
Well, there's a couple things here. Let's not use the word Detroit. Fords are made in Detroit. Ford was not part of the governmental bailout in the same way that GM and Chrysler were. So GM and Chrysler were on the at the edge of bankruptcy. The question is, do you go through a conventional bankruptcy where you say, here are these assets, who wants to continue to build Chevrolets or Cadillacs? And at the time, there were still Pontiacs. And then Buick got to survive also. There would be bidders. Now, how good and strong would those bids be? The president's team felt that the bids that would come in from the private sector at that very sensitive, difficult time in the economy would not be good enough, that they would be fire sale prices, that the government, by stepping in and propping things up, it could get a better deal for the country, let's say. Now, we will never know what private money would have stepped forward, because that was not the route chosen. What was chosen, as Bob said, is a scheme which gave a sweetheart deal, relatively speaking, to the workers, and basically said to shareholders and bondholders, too bad for you guys. It is not necessarily the case that shareholders and bondholders would have come away with nothing if there had been a regular bankruptcy, and it seems likely that the unions would not have done as well. The unions talk about how much they gave up, and they certainly did relative to the contracts they had, but this was a company facing potential liquidation. Romney simply felt that we should go through the established procedure. The president's people said, we're going to do it a different way. What the president does, which is fundamentally unfair, although everything in politics is possible, is to say he just wanted them to go in the toilet and be gone forevermore. But that,
Carl,
was not what he talked about.
But Carl, it does seem odd that, you know, that there's a short memory here. You know, everybody looks back at what Chrysler did back in the 80s, and Lee Iacocca, who, by the way, is a strong Democratic supporter these days. Why wouldn't you put Lee Iacocca up front and say, look, what we did in Chrysler could have been done with GM and Chrysler again? The reality is the Italians are making a boatload of money off the current Chrysler deal after the bailout.
You know, Al Swift and I agree on a lot of things, but one thing in particular, this administration has been lousy at being able to portray what they have done and the benefits for the country. And they were wonderful in the first campaign of getting the message out and getting the message of hope out and winning the first election. But since then, they never sold health care adequately so people could really understand what they were getting. Over the last 6 months, it became more clear because of the discussions that have come out about health care. But a lot of these things, they just, for some reason, either Mr. Axelrod had brain freeze and was happy to be in the White House and closed his memory to what he did before and what he should be able to do the best as far as getting the message out.
Bob Hines, last night's debate, a complete 180 of debate number one. It almost seemed like Governor Romney just called it in. It's like he, as Chuck Todd put it on MSNBC this morning, it was like he didn't want to ace the test, he just wanted to pass the test. Where was, or did in fact, Governor Romney meet expectations last night?
Well, you know, you have to speculate what they were thinking about, and I will here. Number one, on the first debate, he hit a grand slam home run. On the second debate, you know, they both mixed it up a lot, and it was a pretty even deal. From his standpoint, I think he wanted to sound more presidential than just argumentative. And I don't know that that was the best strategy to take, but I think that's what he decided.
Alan Moore?
What you saw from Romney last night was no accident. It was not an off day, as I think it was to some extent with Obama and his disengagement in the first one, and who knows how much preparation. It struck me, and I watched it and thought about it a lot, that this was a conscious decision on his part to stay, if you will, above the fray. He was not going to get in the mud with the president and project charges and countercharges. Having succeeded so much in the first two and even three debates, if you throw the vice presidents in there, that, oh my gosh, this guy Romney, he's not what people had portrayed, had spent hundreds of millions of dollars negatively portraying as a out-of-touch rich guy who's somehow cheating and changes his mind every other day on issues. He makes sense. He speaks in complete sentences. He has talking points and so on. After the second debate, the second presidential debate, there was no bump for Obama. Things stayed stable, and I think a conscious decision was made, let's stay above the fray, let's not get into a tit for tat. I thought there were some times where he should have engaged a little bit more, but as I thought about it, I thought, you know something? He's the one who's coming across more mature, more presidential. Obama's the one who's negative and fierce and on the attack, and it struck me as discordant. And as I thought about it, I thought the people who are going to vote for Obama are going to vote for Obama, his core. The Romney people are now comfortable. There are somewhere between 6 and 10% of the people who are either haven't made up their minds or are subject to changing their minds. That's who Romney's looking for here. And whether the strategy totally worked or not, I have said before, I like Obama, and I like the idea of Obama, and I have not liked the presidency of Obama. After the last two debates, I don't like Obama as much. He is not as likable, and polls are beginning to show this too, just in the last few days. And I was struck by that and reflecting on that as I watched the last night's debate.
But Bob Hines, go ahead.
The thing that, to add to what Alan said, and I didn't say it fully enough at the beginning, for me, as I watched it, I saw the same things Alan did with respect to what Romney was doing. And it seemed to me that almost in every time the president spoke, and I'm probably, maybe not, that's not fair, not almost, but at least half the time the president spoke, it was to bring up some negative argument and just throw something at, you know, at Romney and dare him to start arguing back and forth. And Romney stayed above that and talked substantively about issues and did not take the bait. And I think that is, I think the president looked like he was just, trying to pick a fight, and Romney was just not going to get down in the mud with him today. He was going to talk about the issues he wanted to talk about and on a higher level. And I think, as Alan said, I think it was probably a pretty good strategy.
Go ahead, Carl Tugin.
I see it a little bit differently. Romney is not familiar with foreign policy. And I think what happened, part of it was he was very nervous last night as he came into the debate. You could see it physically. I think that he was uncomfortable. And also, I think I agree with Alan that, you know, he was trying to stay a little bit below the fray. I think the Romney camp feels that the polls are coming their way, and the thing that they didn't want to do is anything to stop that flow. And maybe last night was portrayed that. Very interesting enough, when the debate was over, I turned on Fox just to see what they were saying, and Lutz was doing a focus group, and everyone in the focus group thought that the president had done well, and that he knew what he was talking about. He was presidential. He did it in a very nice way, etc. I was really surprised with that, because I didn't think that would be anything that I would hear on Fox. Now, there were some other things on Fox that I heard today, which, you know, wasn't quite as good as that. I thought the president had a good night again, and we'll have to see what the polls. I think that Romney, it was a different Romney last night, and the Romney last night was much in agreement with the president and his policies, and you couldn't, sometimes you couldn't find much difference between them. He did have a mistake in where he was asked a question, and he talked about Iran and Syria, and that Syria was a way for Iran to get to the sea. And of course, Syria has no sea, but you know, there were little things like that that had said. The president pointed out that Romney has changed his views from the primaries, from the last umpteen months of campaigning against him for the presidency. And it's true, we all know that campaigns go to the center, but in this case, he has come a long way from when he was arguing with the governor of Texas and Newt Gingrich to last night.
But it strikes me that last night, Bob, Mitt Romney, we've always known that foreign policy was never going to be as big as strength, but was a little bit surprised, at least in my view, the lack of confidence that he had. He seemed a little uncomfortable in the foreign policy realm, and that's surprising considering he was prepped by one of the best foreign policy minds on the Senate side, Rob Portman. What happened? Well, was he playing it overly cautious, do you think?
If I am right that he was trying to be more presidential and less argumentative, I think it's possible he overdid it a bit, if that's the case.
Alan Moore, was he more centrist last night than we had seen?
We began to see some of it last week. I think that what we weren't expecting is for him to affirmatively say on a number of issues, I agree with the president on this. I agree with the president on that. I agree with the president. Again, as I said before, I think there were some issues that he could have taken on. I was like Carl. I was surprised that we didn't hear at least a little bit more about Benghazi in the aftermath of last week, where the instant analysis was, boy, Obama cleaned his clock, and then people went back and looked and thought about it and said, actually, Romney was right on this one. And I would have expected that Romney might have tried to play that. But I know these guys would have had to think about that, because that was a logical kind of kickoff point. He wanted to be presidential, or their definition of presidential, calm, measured, respectful, and not try to say not want to be perceived as some kind of a saber rattler that might unnerve independents and women, both groups that Romney has been making inroads in ever since the first debate. One more thing I was thinking about in terms of that I found unattractive from the president was when they got to this question of defense spending, and Romney made this comment about Navy and Navy ships. And he likened it to, or he made this reference to how we have fewer ships than we did in whatever year, 1917 or
yeah.
whatever. And what he didn't say is that requests from the Navy are for a Navy of over 300 ships. We're now at about 280 and it's declining. That would be the argument that would be more contemporary. It was clear that the president was laying in wait here when he made his
bayonet
just so you know,
comment.
We don't have as many horses and bayonets anymore. And then if he had stopped there, I mean, I sort of chuckled. He didn't stop there. He then went on in a way that was disrespectful and belittling and arrogant, in which he said, we have these things called aircraft carriers where airplanes land on them. Oh, and we have these ships that go under the ocean called nuclear submarines. Let your henchmen do that. Presidents don't do that. Challengers do that at their peril. I thought it was a real low point by the president to go there.
Well, I think I think I would agree with you. And I think that was not right. But, you know, there have been plenty of other situations during the campaign in the other debates where I think Governor Romney has either misstated or said something which was not, you know, not that shouldn't have been said. And as you say, challengers beware. Challengers do this because they want to get out there. They want to get their name out there. But that doesn't make it right.
But it did seem, though, that, you know, although the president did seem condescending, overly aggressive in many aspects, Mitt Romney missed the boat on a couple of key items that the president came out on. The biggest example was discounting the threat of Russia under Putin. If the president thinks that Russian under Vladimir Putin is not a new threat and is thinking that the Cold War is completely over, Bob, doesn't that seem a little naive on the president's part?
I don't think it was naive. I think he was just wanting to, in effect, gig Mr. Romney a little bit about saying Russia was the thing. And I think
did Mitt Romney miss the boat on going back on that?
That's one place where I think if I would have been Romney, I would have said, well, you know, you've tried to talk to Putin, and he doesn't want to talk to us. He's not helpful. He's not doing anything helpful at the UN or any place else.
Alan Moore?
I would have left it at that.
You know, Romney made this one reference that people who pay attention to what he was talking about, but he needed to further explain it. And he said, when he talked about getting a message to Mr. Putin that he'd have more flexibility after the election. Well, he needed to remind everybody what exactly happened. The president was overheard saying to then-President Medvedev, hey, tell Mr. Putin that after the election I'll have more flexibility. You needed to spell that out. You needed to challenge the president on that, it seemed to me. I mean, it was one of those things that I would have expected. Fast and Furious is another one, which is an international issue where the administration still has some splaining to do and some embarrassment. There were a handful of issues that I think that Romney in a respectful and forceful way could have brought up. The president would have had a response, no question. He was so kind of controlled and wanting to maintain this demeanor of calm and respectability.
But it also seemed though that the president actually endorsed some of the positions that the president had. He supported the president on the drones. He supported the president on going in after bin Laden, which, again, the president went back after Mitt Romney for making that statement. There was a lot of there was a lot of talk of peace and happiness and global love coming out of Mitt Romney. We didn't see that out of the president last night, even though he had the opportunity to put in a couple of, for lack of a better term, body blows to Governor Romney. Why do you think he missed the boat on that?
It's
Carl Tubin.
It's very hard to say. I think one of the things, Romney has made this statement about Russia a few times before. And, you know, the president and we're trying, the administration is trying to work with Russia on Syria and on some other, I'm sure there are a lot of other issues that they have going with Russia at this time and with the Putin regime. And I think that could play a part in how the president feels and how he reacted. To say that Putin is trying to bring together the old Soviet Union, and I look at that and I say there are a lot of those countries that aren't going to go back under Mother Russia. They have their independence, they have their democracies, they have their all their things. They're not going to want to go back under that again.
Bob Imes.
I think Carl is being generous to the president. Putin has, there isn't one thing that his administration has done that has been helpful that I can see in any place in the world at all. Now, am I surprised by that? No. And it may well be that it's fun to say that jihadists and these and the Taliban's and the Al-Qaeda's are the most dangerous people in the world. If they had nuclear weapons, they certainly would be. They don't now. Hopefully, they never will. But they're very much a difficult. They're the hardest thing to deal with right now in the Middle East, and they will be for I think a long time, unfortunately. But to just dismiss the fact that you know you're so foolish to say Russia is a serious enemy, to me, if I were the president, I wouldn't have just said, oh, that's ridiculous. You know, to be honest, he might have said something to the effect that we've got serious disagreements with Mr. Putin. We've asked him to help with Syria. He doesn't. We've asked him help on a number of other things. He doesn't. And we keep talking to him because we think we should talk
but
to him.
But is Russia the clear and present danger that Governor Romney may allude it may be?
Well, question is, what is a clear and present danger? How do you define it? Now, look, they're the biggest nuclear power in the world except for us. I don't think they're going to blow us up. I don't think we're going to blow them up. But the fact of the matter is, they're a country that any foreign policy decision you make of really big significance brings Russia into play. And they're not being very helpful. They're not being helpful at all. And to somewhat dismissively say, oh, they're not a problem. You know, it's these other guys with these loonies in the Middle East, which is a very serious problem. I'm not minimizing it at all. But I also don't think we should be minimizing the fact that Russia is doing in almost everything we find, whether it's the UN or whether it's actually actions on the ground in places, they're not being helpful.
But one of the comments that we also heard last night was, and one of the big focuses along with jihadists, al-Qaeda, and the threats coming from the Middle East, was the Arab Spring. There are some here in Washington, Alan Moore, that say that Governor Romney missed the boat on his interpretation of how he would have handled the Arab Spring. Didn't show either a lack of true understanding or a true understanding of the relationships between those parties involved. Do you agree with those comments?
The problem is we kind of weren't prepared for Arab Spring to occur. We stood by as witnesses, and then belatedly in most of the countries, and I'm not picking a fight over this, once we saw the final general direction of things, we said, oh yeah, get Mubarak out of there. We weren't in the lead on that. Get Saddam Hussein out of there. We weren't in the lead. We were trying to figure out what was going to occur. We didn't want to get crossways with history here. You see that problem in the case of Syria, where Assad, more than a year later, is still in power after we've said he needs to go. He's killed 33,000 people now, and neither one of these guys, though, is prepared to be very aggressive about a no-fly zone, which would be the logical next big thing to do.
But Governor Romney seemed to disagree and go for a more peaceful diplomatic solution in a lot of these instances.
Not more. I wouldn't say he was disagreeing. I think he was about the only difference between the only daylight between him and Obama on some of these issues was
he said peace more than Obama.
More of the same. Be more assertive and more aggressive in these diplomatic outreach. But that has no particular meaning. It doesn't really resonate. It sounds like we're basically in agreement on many of these countries.
Carl Dubin, as a Democrat, you had to look at all this and say, wait a minute, we seem to be in a bizarro world where the president's talking like a true war hawk, and I've got the Republican sitting there like he's in bed with Yoko Ono saying, give peace a chance.
You know, the fact is that over many months, the administration has been actively working with our allies, with Saudi Arabia and other Arab, one other Arab country, to get munitions to the rebels. Now, we had a glitch three, four weeks ago about who was getting the weapons. And I think they've they've tried to solve that problem. Syria, on the other hand, I found out the other day, is letting through their sources. The rebels have guns, and they have within the gun an explosive. So when you shoot the gun, it blows up and kills the person or harms the person and people around them.
Really?
Yes.
I would love to see that report. Bob Hines, go ahead.
Well, just one thought. I think it's been said before, but we should remind ourselves. There is not a Democratic or a Republican foreign policy. Never has been, never should be. It should not be that way. There should be, what is the best thing for our goals in the world? We want a peaceful world. We want a safe world. We don't want countries disintegrating. We don't want nuclear weapons getting in the hands of bad people, whether it's countries or groups. And, you know, the reason that there was some considerable agreements, or at least not disagreements, was the fact that both of them recognize that there are some things that need to be, and foreign policy is certainly one of them, is an area where politics should stop at the water's edge, and foreign policy should be handled by the smartest people we've got who understand and recognize what the problem is.
You think Romney hit the mark on that last night?
Yeah. I think he did. I think the president tried, too, in a number of areas. I also think he got off, he really got kind of snippy a few times, as Alan said, about things he did not have to argue about it.
Right.
But the fact of the matter is, on a lot of big foreign policy issues, there really are not differences between most of the policies we're talking about.
Including Israel?
There seems to be... Well, I don't know that the policy is different, but the president is certainly less supportive of the current administration in Israel than previous presidents have been, of both parties.
Carl Toobin.
You know, they've had some disagreements, and the disagreements have been in the open. But basically, this administration has given more aid, as we have our troops there with the Israeli troops, having having maneuvers, etc. So, you know, it isn't the closest of relationships, but between the president and Netanyahu, but this administration has backed up Israel thus far to the hilt. And I say thus far, I don't think it's going to change. I don't think it's going to change in the second term.
That's assuming Obama gets elected.
That's right. Well,
Alan Moore.
He's the only one that's going to be a second term.
Alan Moore, you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that the president early on in the administration tested the waters for, if you will, creating daylight, a little more daylight between our government and their government, and it didn't work out too well for them, and they're now joined at the hip again. And that's, you know, he made a very serious outreach to the Muslim world early in his administration, and you can't really have that outreach and not suggest any possible change in the relationship with Israel. Over time, his other entreaties, his other efforts led nowhere and were creating serious problems for him with the American Jewish community. And I think, and then experience. It's not just a political decision. I think experience then tells you over time, you know, maybe these guys, we have this close relationship with Israel for reasons other than just politics. And this Muslim world really is a very tough nut to crack. So he's come back to be much closer. Point is, that's where he is now. It's not just a political opportunism. I think it's political understanding and maturity that's involved. So I don't see any some other big change on the horizon.
Carl Toobin.
Yeah. I want to talk about that. the trip that they made and the Secretary of State made. I think at the beginning of the administration, they had a idea that if we can become closer to some of these Arab states, that we might be able to bring them to the table for negotiations and get the two parties together to come out with a peace agreement. Unfortunately, it didn't work, and it left a bad taste in the mouths of many Jews who said, "What are they doing?" And in the Arab world, because of the fact that, as we historically have been, staying close to Israel had a bad taste in their mouth. So, you know, and it was an attempt in my mind and others, it was an attempt to try to do something that hadn't been done before to see if we could bring these people together and to do something positive.
Very good. Round the horn question before we go to break. Alan Moore, start with you. Who got the biggest bump last night, if anybody?
Biggest bump last night? I don't see a bump. And although I think that by staying above the fray and not getting into the mud, Romney helped himself more than Obama helped himself.
Bob Hines, same question.
Pretty much the same answer. I would call it. If you're someone who was looking for your candidate to go and attack, then if that's what the Obama people wanted, they got it. And I think maybe the president felt that he was he's been losing ground in the polls, and I think not by a whole lot, but it isn't. You don't need very much movement right now to have a significant shift. And I think he still felt he had to go on the offensive, and he did. I think he was a little bit too aggressive sometimes. But on the other hand, I think that Romney himself, I would have liked to have seen him be just a little bit, raise a couple of questions that he didn't raise. But on the whole, I think his goal was to sound like a person who understood the seriousness of the issues they were talking about, and was not, these are not to be politicized so much as to be dealt with by any administration, because they're going to be on the president's table, period. And I think he was trying to look like a guy who knew that these were serious issues and they had to be dealt with that way, not fighting.
Carl Toobin.
I think that the president wanted to show that he was presidential, wanted to show that he had a real understanding of foreign policy, as he does, and I think he achieved that. We'll have to wait 2, 3 days, 4 days to see what the polls say. It's a very, very close race, as we all know, and I think he was trying to reach out to his base and get them more enthused, and also to the to what's left of the independent vote.
Very good. Next week, I want to focus on the push going into the election. We're going to be a week out of the election next week. The election's basically coming down to 7 states, and if you really want to get into the weeds, you're looking at 3 states, that being Florida, Virginia, and number one, Ohio.
Ohio.
Everything's going, looking at the Buckeye State. We're going to focus on that next week. But when we come back from break, we've got Dr. Jeffrey Crouch, a professor up at American University. He's the author of a really interesting book called The Power of the Presidential Pardon. We're going to interview him about his book and get the feel of the college mentality of the upcoming election. When we come back, this is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us.
You know, here on Backroom Politics, you hear us order drinks during happy hour, the second hour of Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio. But what you don't understand is the quality of the drink that we're getting here at Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Backroom Politics premier sponsor. Hey, you got Dave Hammerly and the bar crew there at Shelley's Back Room that really know how to pour a drink. Whether it's something simple like my on-air Jack Daniels on the rocks with a splash of water, or whether it's something elaborate like what has to be the best martini in the District of Columbia for Congressman Al Swift. Wine selection, scotch selection that will blow your mind. They've got Highland scotches. They've got Isle of Skye scotches, blended, single malt. Anything you want. Port wines to go with that great cigar from the great humidor. Down here at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Come on down, have a drink, and make some new friends. Or heck, just come on down and listen to Backroom Politics on Tuesdays.
Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Back Room. By the way, our phone lines are open if you want to call in and join the discussion, talk about the power of the presidential pardon. If you want to talk about any of the other topics we brought up today, you can dial us toll-free, 877-662-3713. Again, that number is 877-662-3713. Joining us right now, he is a professor of political science up at the great American University here in Northwest Washington, D.C. He is the author of the Presidential Pardon Power. He is Dr. Jeffrey Crouch. Jeff, how you doing?
I'm good, man. How are you?
Welcome. Thanks for joining us today. Appreciate you coming
thanks
in.
Thanks for having me.
Jeff, we've known you for a couple of years. We give a usual biannual or a semiannual speech up at American University for a lot of your students, but come to find out, you've written a book called The Presidential Pardon Power.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about the book real quick.
Yeah. Well, the book's about the presidential pardon power. It focuses on this constitutional power of the president that a lot of people don't really think a whole lot about, except around Thanksgiving when a turkey gets pardoned by the president, or one of those rare times during the year when the president actually issues some pardons. So I did some research, and I figured out that the last book-length examination of clemency by a political scientist was in 1941, and a lot's happened since then, so I thought this would be a good topic to take a look at and, you know, explain how it works and some of the famous examples and sort of where I think things are heading with it. So,
when you wrote the book, what gave you the inspiration? What inspired you to come up with the idea about talking about something that is relatively not widely known as the power of the presidency?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I've studied the presidency in graduate school, and I started looking around for a dissertation topic. And I looked at things like war powers, and I looked at the constitutional powers of the president in addition to the commander-in-chief clause and things like that. And that's where I came across this language in Article 2 that says, you know, the president shall have the power to grant reprieves and pardons for offenses against the United States. I thought, well, here's a constitutional power, and nobody's written on it for a decade. So I figure, well, this will be my dissertation topic, and I'll do some research here. And so that's sort of how it came about. And then I transformed the manuscript from my dissertation into a book manuscript.
Now, we've seen the power of the presidential pardon evolve over the scope of the history of this country. What was once used very rarely in very special occasions in areas that may have been deemed either unjust or in there was inequity involved, it's now become more of a political tool in the modern day presidency. Where did that transition start?
Yeah, well, I think the pardon has sort of always been political in a sense, in that it's a case-by-case thing and presidents will use it for various reasons. I think the most striking thing about how it's used today is the circumstances under which presidents are using it for personal reasons. And one of the major themes of the book is basically to look at Presidents George H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton, and George W. Bush, and look at their controversial uses of the clemency power in circumstances where they're either rewarding a supporter or a donor, or they're sort of covering themselves a little bit in circumstances where they could face some legal action.
Bob Hines.
And if I'm not right, this is an absolute power. I mean, there's no appeal from this. If the president decides to give a pardon, that's it.
Correct. The pardon is a check and balance power. It's a check on the power of the judiciary. And as such, the only recourse anybody has if they dislike a pardon is, you know, impeach the president or amend the Constitution. That's basically it. So it's an all but unlimited power. And
that's a pretty minor protection, I guess.
Right, right. Yeah. You know, the framers actually discussed whether or not it should be that way. And, you know, if you look at the debates, they talked about putting potential limits on the pardon power, forcing the president to share it with the Senate, putting limits in the Constitution itself on when it could be used, and ultimately they decided, well, you know, it makes the most sense to give this pretty much all but unlimited power to the president and trust him, and if something goes wrong, you've got the impeachment power.
Now, Jeff, we look at, you know, some of the recent pardons, but one that stands out most notably that caused a lot of divisiveness in the American electorate was the Gerald R. Ford pardon of former President Richard Nixon.
Of course.
Did that impact the way that the American public viewed the pardon? Did it then, at that point, look like this is a true tool at the will of the presidency?
Yeah, I think the Nixon pardon was really important. I mean, you know, I think that the Nixon pardon, Gerald Ford said at the time, you know, I'm doing this because I need to be able to do my job. People are asking me about Richard Nixon. I'm spending 25% of my time answering questions about Richard Nixon. I need to make this decision. And I think at the time, a lot of people thought, well, this is outrageous. You know, Nixon hasn't stood trial. We don't know what he actually did because he's just sort of pardoned and then everything goes away. But I think with hindsight being 2020, I think a lot of people have come to realize that that decision actually was consistent with what the framers had in mind for the pardon power in the Constitution, which was, you know, the president should use it either as an act of mercy show toward an individual or under circumstances where it's best for the public welfare. And I think what ended up happening with the Nixon situation is, you know, clearly there was some sort of pre-existing relationship between Nixon and Ford. They knew each other a little bit. People will argue about how well. And some people said, well, this is clearly a payoff. Nixon's going to resign and Ford's going to pardon him. I don't think that's actually what was going on. I mean, I think that this is a case where Ford did what he had to do. He knew it would hurt. He knew it would cost his party. But he did it because it had to be done. And, you know, ultimately public opinion has shifted on it over time. It took a long time. But the Kennedy Library recognized Ford with its Profiles in Courage Award. And Ted Kennedy said, you know, that was the right thing to do. You showed a lot of courage in doing that.
Bob Hines, you were very close to the Ford administration. You were deep in the thick of that.
I was.
How do you recall that time in the White House? And that had to have been a very troubling decision for the president to make at that time.
It was a difficult position to take from a political standpoint. But as Jeff said, Ford's biggest problem was every time he turned around, somebody was asking him, what's going on with Nixon? What are you going to do about it? And he literally decided that he was going to put it behind him, and he thought it was the right thing to do because he had a job to do in the presidency. There were serious problems at that time, and he knew he was going to have a hard time getting, as long as that was there, and he, every time he had a press conference or he talked about something, somebody would stay, rather than talking about what I'm talking about to you, they would say, what are you going to do about Nixon? And after about 3 or 4 weeks, it was literally within a month of his ascent to the presidency, it was over the Labor Day weekend, or just right after, he was about a month, and he had literally just been overwhelmed, and he talked to a few people. I was not one of the people he talked to, but I was there, and I knew what was going on. And he sent one of us out to a good friend who I won't mention, out to talk to the doctors. And the doctors said Nixon is really, you know, going over the edge.
Right.
And I think that's an accurate, really very accurate. And the last thing that Ford wanted was to have Nixon, you know, do something crazy, you know,
right,
commit suicide or start, you know, coming out and saying all kind of things, or just suddenly becoming dementia and you know, going into a mental hospital and being a babbling idiot.
Right.
No, and I think in hindsight, the only thing that we would have done differently was not just talk to the doctors that from UCLA, I think it was, who were Nixon's doctors, but also get an outside source.
Right, right.
Didn't do that, and it would have been smart to do it.
Right. Alan Moore.
Yeah, I've studied this issue a bit myself, and it seems to me that it wasn't so much that Ford was being asked about this every time and turned around. He wasn't meeting with the press. He wasn't holding a weekly press conference or anything like that. He was getting calls every other day from Julie Nixon, the president's daughter, President Nixon's daughter, begging him to save her father's life because he was borderline suicidal. The mistake that I think President Ford made, and I worked for him in the White House later, had great admiration for the man, but his mistake in my mind in the pardon was that he didn't lay groundwork with the public. That if he had let it be known, or let surrogates let it be known, that inside the White House they were wrestling with this question because they were worried that it was going to consume the country, and at a time where we had serious economic challenges and needed to move forward on this whole other major set of issues important to the country, that it wouldn't have come as such a surprise. It came as such a surprise that his own press secretary quit on the spot the day he found out about it. That shows what a close hold there was on this news. That was a mistake. It fed the narrative that there was some kind of quid pro quo understanding between Nixon and Ford when Nixon made this, you know, rather dramatic and extraordinarily difficult decision to step down.
Right. Well, Jeff, this leads me into my next question: is, you know, when we look at the President's Club, you know, they all seek each other's advice out. The recent book about the President's Club talks about how influential one and the other are, and it's made for strange bedfellows. Obviously, Clinton talking and seeking out advice from Nixon. George W., the relationship between Bill Clinton and George H.W. Bush for President 41. Is there any, do they confide in each other when looking at using the power of the pardon nowadays, or has there been a history where they talk to each other about, is this the right move?
I'm not aware that there's been direct communication as far as when to unleash your controversial pardons. I mean, I think the thing that I note in the book is that, you know, the last three presidents before Barack Obama each did something very controversial. I don't know that there's really a common thread between them other than the fact that they found it advantageous to use the clemency power when they did, basically when they were free from electoral repercussions. They were either term limited out or they'd lost the reelection bid, and an opportunity came along where it made more sense for them to use the pardon power and risk the backlash from the public that comes from doing that and risk the damage to their legacy as opposed to not doing anything at all. So, you know, the situation has been a little bit different, but, you know, the overall context is cost-benefit analysis. Does it make sense to use the power?
What's the most noble use of the presidential pardon that you found in your writings?
Well, I think the most noble one is the Nixon pardon. I mean, I think Ford knew that he was going to fall on his sword, and, you know, he didn't have the luxury of waiting to the end of his term like some of his more, some of his successors, but he did it anyway. Noble, I mean, you could argue that the post-Civil War amnesties were noble. You know, we're forgiving a lot of things to try to persuade the rebels to come back and rejoin the Union.
What about the most obscure, weirdest pardon that you found?
The most obscure, I mean, some of the most obscure ones are going on now. I mean, if you look at how Barack Obama and George W. Bush have used the clemency power, or rather not used the clemency power, you know, it's become, in a lot of ways, almost a non-factor. I mean, Barack Obama has issued 23 pardons and commutations over the course of almost a full term as president. And that's a small number. George W. Bush, about 200 total, which is still a small number. When you look at folks like FDR, you know, thousands, 3,000-4,000 pardons. Truman, hundreds. The most obscure ones that come to mind right now as I sit here, Barack Obama pardoned a guy who was busted of mutilating currency. He would take nickels and he would cut them down to the size of dimes and he put them in vending machines. Mutilating the currency, he got caught for that and he got in trouble for that. Another guy sold alligator hides illegally. Who knew that was a federal offense? But these sort of trivial things are what the pardon power in a lot of cases has come down to these days, because there's nothing to be gained for the president to stick his neck out and say, I'm going to forgive this class of offense or this, you know, type of offense, unless it's a old nonviolent offense.
Wow.
You mentioned obscure.
Yeah.
What were the noteworthy ones that Clinton and the two Bushes did? I know,
yeah,
probably Mark Rich and Clinton, which I'll let you...
Right, yeah, yeah. What, I mean, noteworthy in the sense that people heard about them and went, what? Huh? What's that all about? Yeah, I mean, I think George H.W. Bush, the most noteworthy one he did was Caspar Weinberger and the other Iran-Contra defendants.
Mm-hmm.
We can talk about that more if you want. Bill Clinton, actually, there's a couple of them. He offered conditional clemency to members of the FALN, which is his Puerto Rican nationalist terrorist organization, despite the fact that law enforcement that investigated their case uniformly said these people should not receive clemency. He did it anyway, and in the book I argue that really the only thing that makes sense is he saw political advantage to doing so, and that's why he did it. At the end of his term, of course, the Mark Rich pardon. Mark Rich was the financier who had fled the country to avoid standing trial. But while he was gone, his ex-wife conducted this behind-the-scenes campaign, which involved $500,000 donation to the Clinton Library to get him a pardon, which he received.
What about the Scooter Libby decision?
Scooter Libby, well, that's George W. Bush's controversial decision. Well, one of Bush's controversial decisions, the one that people probably remember the most. Libby, of course, was Dick Cheney's chief of staff. He got caught up in the Valerie Plame CIA identity investigation, and he ended up being sentenced to go to prison and fined, and Bush decided that his sentence was quote-unquote excessive, and so he reduced the sentence from 30 months in prison to no time at all. And that was one of those clemency decisions that a lot of pundits saw coming. I mean, as soon as the Libby's name surfaced in regard to this investigation, people started sort of taking bets on when was the decision going to be made. Was it going to be a pardon? Was it going to be a commutation? And by the way, a pardon is the most complete form of forgiveness that the president can bestow A commutation is just a reduction of the sentence.
And he gave him a commutation, not a pardon, which was a piece of controversy and it's still continuing issue between him and Cheney.
Yeah, exactly. Apparently Vice President Cheney pushed pretty hard for a whole pardon and
he was pissed.
Was disappointed. Yeah. Very disappointed.
Are we eventually going to see a change in the way that the president uses the pardon as we go forward? In today's social media, in today's world of universal data, is that going to be a more closely held power that the president's going to use, more selective?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what we're seeing today. And I think it's no coincidence that you see pretty much a straight line decline. There's, of course, other factors involved. I mean, Margaret Love, who's a former pardon attorney, has written extensively on who's reviewing the clemency applications in the pardon attorney's office. And it turns out it's former prosecutors, so there's not a lot of recommendations being made for clemency coming up from the bureaucracy to the president. And at the same time, I think that there's very little incentive for the president to tell the pardon attorney, send me 100 applications of people who deserve clemency. So there's a logjam going up the chain, and then there's a logjam coming down the chain. I think technology plays an important role in that. In fact, the other sort of prominent George W. Bush clemency decision that a lot of people don't remember anymore was his decision to give a pardon to a guy named Isaac Robert Tusi, who he was a businessman and he had mistreated some folks regarding mortgages, especially minority folks, and got in trouble for it and received a pardon, or so we thought, because hours after the announcement was made through the press release that Isaac Robert Tusi was on a master clemency warrant receiving clemency, Bush sent out his press secretary to say, well, actually, we never actually granted clemency to Mr. Tusi. What ended up happening was New York newspapers had gotten a hold of this decision and had investigated and raised a stink about it, and then Bush decided to retract it.
Right.
And as somebody who's followed this, I don't agree with what Mr. Tusi did, but I don't think Mr. Bush gets to retract the pardon once it's been included in a master clemency warrant and announced to the world. And there's a whole dispute about, well, is it the master warrant with all the names on it that pardons, or is it the individual warrant with one name on it that pardons? The Bush administration is saying as long as he doesn't get the individual warrant that says you're pardoned, he's not pardoned. And prior practice up to that point, since the Eisenhower administration pretty much said as long as the name's on the master warrant and it's announced, that's a pardon.
Right. So, Your book's available on Amazon?
It's available on Amazon. That's probably the best place to get it, although the University Press of Kansas, which published the book, also has it available on its website.
Great. Bob Einstein, we have one last.
Very quick question.
Sure.
Do you think there is any reason to believe that the absolute power of the presidency to offer pardons should ever be should be limited by any way by a change in the Constitution?
That's a great question. I mean, that's what it would end up taking, right, amending the Constitution. 27 amendments to the Constitution over 220-some years, I think it would take a pretty big scandal for that to happen. And I think, I guess one of the downsides of the Nixon pardon and then these other controversial ones that I discussed is these are pretty controversial things, and those in the mind of the public and Congress didn't rise to the level of doing anything other than holding some hearings.
Well, if Nixon pardon didn't do it,
exactly. And I don't think it's realistic to think it will.
Great. The book is The Presidential Pardon Power,
right,
available on Amazon. The author, Dr. Jeff Crouch. Jeff, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, appreciate
it. Great read. I urge everybody to take a look at this. If you're interested in presidential politics, it's a great, great book on the history and what may be happening as we move forward. When we come back, we are going to have the author of the book In the Shade of the Mango Tree, Oil and Murder in the Congo by David Porter. We'll have him next. This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We'll be back in 1 minute. Stay with us.
Everybody knows Shelley's Back Room for its corporate events, its happy hours, its famous campfire wings and fruit cigars and drinks. But what you didn't know is that Shelley's is open during the weekend, too. In fact, Shelley's Back Room on the weekends even has a non-smoking section. You can bring your family, your kids, enjoy the same campfire wings and same glorious food that you enjoy during the week, but without the famous Shelley's cigar environment. Also, during the weekend, it's football season. That means a lot of the regulars come down and enjoy their drinks and their favorite cigars, all while watching their favorite local teams, whether it's the Ravens, the Redskins, on several HD screens throughout the place. So remember, Shelley's Back Room, it's not just for happy hours anymore. 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., official sponsor of Backroom Politics.
No one to talk with all by myself. No one to walk with, but I'm happy on the elevation, on the shelf. Hey, misbehaving. Saving my love for you, and you, especially you, yeah. I know for certain.
And we're back here, Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio. Joining us now is the author of the new book, In the Shade of the Mango Tree, Oil, Politics, and Murder in the Congo. It's author and friend of Shelley's Back Room, Mr. David Porter. How you doing, David?
I'm great, Justin. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Interesting title, interesting concept. Now, this is a novel.
It is.
That you've written. Tell us a little bit about the book itself. What's the basis on this?
I'd be delighted to. And I wanted to say first that it was fascinating to sit in and listen to Alan and Bob and Carl talk about the political campaign that's going on now.
Right.
And I think one of the great achievements of the American system is our ability to transition power peacefully.
Right.
Without violence.
Right.
And that reminds me that in West Africa, in the Congo,
where the book is set,
where the setting of the book, there was a paper written by a professor Thomas Konza called Prison, Exile, or Death, and those essentially were the three options that were open to former heads of state of the Congo. And that essentially was the genesis for the events and the adventures that led to the writing of the novel. Professor Konza was living in London, and he had a friend who was a former student of my partner. He asked us to come to London and evaluate his chances for being democratically elected and overthrowing, I guess that's a bit of a contradiction, but replacing President Mobutu in Zaire, former Belgian Congo.
Now you talk about this group coming from a small southern town, one of them former comms guy, strategic communications guy, the other former naval special operations officer. In talking before the show, you had said that there's some reality mixed in with this novel. Can you talk about that?
I'm fond of saying that about 70% of what happened in the novel is 100% true. The 30% I leave up to the reader to determine that. Most of the adventures, I guess with the exception of the murder and mayhem, although that may have happened, were actual events. And in starting to write the novel, it really started off as a sort of a journey and travel log. But it evolved into a murder novel based on the animosity that we were confronted with by the French and the French National Oil Company, Elf Aquitaine. We were the first group of Americans to come into the Congo after the first democratically elected administration came to power, and we looked to build commercial bridges between the Congo and America. The French, particularly Elf Aquitaine, did not like that. That was their backyard, and we were perceived as a threat. So many of the projects that we undertook to support the president were met with, in the novel certainly, with violence. And it's a way to present the framework of American interests going into an area of the world where there aren't really any perceived American interests. And that's what we came across. And it led to some interesting politics and some interesting events.
Now, you've obviously done research on this book, obviously from personal experience.
I have.
in
Was it easy to make that leap from what was factual into taking creative license and writing it as a novel?
No, it seemed to flow fairly easily. For example, the president, President Basula, is the character in the book, asked us to recover $800 million that he felt had been embezzled by the former president, which was a project that we undertook. And we engaged a Kroll and Associates from New York, who had been instrumental in recovering the Marcos billions that had been sequestered and secreted around the world, and they were happy to come in and help us with the project. They wanted a fee. The Congolese government wanted a contingency arrangement, and of course that didn't work out, in as much as the Congo didn't have the resources to pursue it.
Alan Moore, you have a question?
No.
Oh, okay. It's like you had your finger up. In the book, you talk about that there's a perceived notion in Africa that America really doesn't have an interest in what's going on, particularly on that oil-rich Western Horn. Are you finding that that is a large misconception also brought on the other side of the ocean here in the U.S.?
I think it is to the extent that other than oil, the commercial interests are so far-flung and so difficult that they're really not worth pursuing. Oil, of course, is an entirely different matter, and that's where the conflict was generated, not only in the novel, but in our real-life experience. And that was between an American oil company, Occidental Petroleum out of Dallas, and El Fakatain. El Fakatain had been, going back to De Gaulle, had been perceived as the engine of the Gaullist movement in Francophonie. The colonies had achieved independence, but in the view from Paris, they felt that the oil was still their preserve and that it was theirs exclusively. So any outside interference was not received well.
The cover of the book.
Yes.
There's an interesting story behind the cover image on the book. Talk a little bit about that, because that's a great story.
Well, the in the...
Let me talk real quick. Sure. First, talk about the name of the book. How'd you come up with the name?
Well, Paul Thoreau wrote a travelogue. He's revisiting his time in Africa. He did a road trip from Cairo to Cape Town. And over a year or so period, he drove along the roads of East Africa. He came across a village where there was a lone mango tree under which 30 or so villagers were huddled in the shade. And he was struck by this. It was 110 degrees or so. And he was struck by their essentially survival ritual of staying in the shade of the mango tree and moving throughout the afternoon, in the heat of the afternoon, as the shade of the mango tree moves. And it struck Thoreau that here's a mango tree with thousands of seeds that could have been planted, and he could have had many mango trees. But rather than do that, they chose simply to move in the shade of the mango tree.
And the image on the book, interesting story behind that. Talk about that for a second.
Well, yeah, it plays out throughout the, particularly toward the end of the novel. But the image I found on the internet, there was a young woman who was traveling in Guinea-Bissau, and she had posted this image on her travel blog, and I was struck by it because it was so typically an African village. The colors were wonderful. So I wrote her and asked her permission to use the image, and said that it was going to be on a cover art on my novel, and that I would be delighted if you'd give me permission. I would send her copies of the book and give her attribution in the book. I didn't hear from her. Months go by, and I continue writing, and I write her again. I must have written half a dozen emails and never heard from her. And I consulted the publisher and said, look, it's a public domain. You know, let's go ahead and use it. So I used it, and I've given her attribution for the photo. But it always struck me that she is out there somewhere traveling in Africa, in West Africa, probably either by herself or with a group of other young people. And I have no idea what's happened to her, and I'm not sure anyone knows.
Interesting. Now, you're on a book tour right now. You just had a book signing in Charleston. You're going to have a book signing here.
Yes, I am.
In Shelley's back room tomorrow night, beginning at 6 p.m.
Actually, starting at noon.
Starting at noon.
Tomorrow and Thursday.
Oh, okay. All right, wonderful. So anybody who's interested in buying the book, now they can buy the book online through your website and through Amazon?
They can. And Shelley's has been so kind to offer anyone that comes to buy a book a cigar and a drink. So it's sort of, we're bundling.
And a signed copy of the book, obviously.
Of course.
I mean,
that's the lesser of the three, but yeah.
It's a trifecta. You get the great book, and you get a cigar, and you get a drink at the same time.
Indeed.
Going back to the book itself, you know, when we hear a lot of what's going on in Nigeria and mm-hmm. the conflict that's happening in Lagos between the government and the oil companies.
Right.
And the politics and the blood that is spilled over oil. How important is the oil factor in the writing of this book right now? And is that something that we see changing in the near future?
Well, it's hard to say. I think perhaps it could be tied to the price of oil. Obviously, if the price of oil goes up, it becomes much more attractive to undertake the risks, because the risks are considerable. So it will continue, but again, I think it's something that is very difficult for, as powerful as the American oil interests are, it's difficult for them to encroach on what has traditionally and continues to be a French domain.
The French still have a lot of influence, or are we seeing them deteriorate that influence?
Well, Elf Aquitaine, the national oil company, has morphed into, well, they were purchased by Total, so I guess you could characterize it as a European Union oil concern, and it remains a key part of their economy. So have we ceded that the oil leases to them? Probably for all practical purposes, until it becomes much more attractive to compete for.
Any plans on a second book?
Well, I thought about tracking down the young woman whose image is on the cover, and maybe going from there. I thought perhaps, well, maybe there's an opportunity to find her in the midst of a CIA rendition. A program and jihadists. Now that's is that typical of what happens over there? Probably not. It is fiction, after all.
Now you're a formal naval officer, former
yes,
naval
sir.
Aviator,
and special operations. Right.
Former special operations. I guess we can also say on your website, former CIA.
Yeah.
Did you tap into a lot of this during your writing on this?
Some of the experience with the special operations, my CIA experience is maybe this isn't a fair comparison, but I was a summer intern because my father was a CIA officer at Langley, so I had the experience and the impact, maybe not of, say, a Monica Lewinsky. She worked at the White House. She was an intern. But
I was going to say. That was a bit of a shift there.
Forward to that. You
better add a little more information here.
How much time do we have? We're in a cigar bar here, Dan.
That's another book.
Yeah, I'm kidding.
That would be a great book.
I thought everyone was relaxing a little bit, so I thought,
so quickly we lose control.
I know. It just goes right out the window. So I did. I used a lot of that experience. In fact, the opening chapter of the book was taken from an experience I had in Syria with the defense attaché. It seemed to him like a good idea. I was working with JSOC at the time. I never would have said that, but that doesn't seem to be something that nobody that anybody seems to close.
JSOC being the Joint Special Operations Command and DOD.
That's correct. And we went on a tour of a Palestinian refugee camp in an SUV that seemed exciting at the time, but in retrospect seemed a bit foolhardy. But it didn't turn out, it didn't end up so well in the novel. So.
Oh, okay. Now, the book is the book available on your Kindle as well?
It is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and of course here at Shelley's with a cigar and a drink.
Right. Fantastic. The book, again, is In the Shade of the Mango Tree, Oil, Politics, and Murder in the Congo. I just started reading it. It is a great read.
Thank you very much.
Very intriguing. Great book if you're into international intrigue, spy novels. Like, not exactly James Bond, but it is a great read nonetheless. The author is David Porter. Mr. Porter, thanks for joining us. Appreciate you having on the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
Great having you.
Thank you.
Again, tomorrow, Shelley's Back Room starting at 12 p.m. You come in for a book signing, a cigar, and a drink, and David Porter will be here to sign the books. Hopefully, I'm sure we'll get a great turnout of people intrigued about the book. When we come back, it's time for my favorite segment, Tell Me a Story. This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We'll be back in 1 minute. Stay with us. You know, you hear us talk about Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. It's being the place to be. America's premier cigar tavern, place to make new friends or visit old friends, or even have a lively political discussion like we do here on Backroom Politics. But what you may not know, Shelley's is the place for private parties. Shelley's Back Room is available to host events for groups of 10 to 250. From cocktail receptions to sit-down dinners, Shelley's can provide custom menu options to suit your needs and budget. Although Shelley's is a smoke-friendly environment, Shelley's can make accommodations for non-smokers based on the size of your party, but heck, why would you want to? With a cigar menu like they have here, why would you even consider going smoke-free? Event pricing varies based on the time of the day of the week chosen for your event. For more information on private parties at Shelley's Back Room, go to www.shelleysbackroom.com/private-party. Shelley's Back Room, the place to be, as Bob likes to say it. It's also the place for private parties. Street in the heart of our nation's.
The country who's paying any attention to politics understands that Medicare, the program of health care for the elderly and for disabled people, is heading in a sharp downhill slope. There is a court case in Vermont which is about to be finalized that it is going to speed up the downhill slope. The government, for reasons not yet explained, is apparently going to settle a class action suit against the government over Medicare policy, which says if you go into a nursing home or need home health care after you've been after a Medicare hospital stay or have had some kind of an episode, if you go in for rehabilitation, current policy says Medicare will reimburse only if you are improving. What the government is reportedly going to do is settle this by saying you don't have to be improving if you are stable or even if it slows down your deterioration, Medicare will pay.
this is a staggering enterprise that's going to mean tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of people are going to get would get Medicare reimbursement for some of their nursing home care, home health care, or other special rehab needs. Congress has not been informed of this. Watch out for a multi-billion dollar opening of this Medicare door that we'll be hearing a lot about in the near future.
Oh, that's got to be something to keep an eye on. Bob Hines, tell me a story.
The election is in about 2 weeks from today, and we'll know the president that night. The first thing that the incumbent president, if he is reelected, or the new president, if he has to start thinking about it, is going to be between the time of the election and the first of the year, we have the fiscal cliff, as we call it here
right.
in Washington, where all the lots of the government programs and the tax structure will be fundamentally changed, and huge cuts will be made in both domestic and defense programs if the government, which means the Congress here, does not solve a problem of how to enact legislation to, you know, in effect, protect us from cutting required cuts that are now set up to occur, both in the tax program and in the entitlement programs. Now, I'm sorry, the government programs, not Social Security and not Medicare. The guess is right now, if you can speculate, and it's probably early to do so, but what you tend to hear now when you talk to people up on Capitol Hill is that the best thing we can possibly do, because the lame duck Congress, which will be the Congress which will have to which would have to write the legislation, will probably be unable to reach an agreement. They haven't been able to reach an agreement for the last 3 years. And the odds are that we will kick that down the road probably as much as 6 months.
Wow.
Which means that we will continue
to dangle.
We will continue to take money away from Social Security, and we will continue to just fuss around for the next 6 months. It'll be a new Congress, and that's a good thing.
Wow. Bob, keep an eye on that, because that's obviously something that's going to come back after the election and haunt a lot of people. Carl Toobin, tell me a story.
First, let's hope that the election is over the night of the election.
Good
that it doesn't
point.
Go on Matt. And on and on.
Good point.
last night, Mr. Schieffer made a mistake, which evidently is a common mistake. When he was talking about Osama bin Laden, he said Obama bin Laden. Bin Laden. This is a mistake that was shared by many other commentators and people who spoke about Osama bin Laden on the day he was shot, one of which was Diane Sawyer and other persons in the news media. I found it fascinating. And hopefully a story that everyone's interested in.
Yeah, interesting. My story is had an email exchange between NBC Chief White House Correspondent, Washington Bureau Chief Chuck Todd and myself. Last week, Chuck Todd put together four possible scenarios where we could see an Electoral College tie. All scenarios are feasible, but his last scenario is one that the polls right now show could be a reality come election night. We may have a situation where we may be at 265, and we will have to go to Congress for resolution, in which case the House of Representatives, the incoming House, will elect the president, the incoming Senate will elect the vice president, which possibly means
there is a scenario out there that is realistic that we can see the first time in our history a possible coalition government of a Republican president and a Democratic vice president. It is not beyond the thought of reason that Romney-Biden might be a reality. Keep an eye on that. Chuck Todd emailed me back and said, this keeps me up at night. If anything, I think it makes for great media. We'll have something to talk about well into the new year. On behalf of, exactly. On behalf of the Honorable Alan Moore, Honorable Bob Hines, Carl Tuvin, I'm your moderator, Justin Russell. We will be back next week. By the way, we'll be on the air live Election Day, talking and hopefully handicapping a very interesting presidential run that day. But we will be back next week, same time, same station. Radio's Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Bob?
For the place to be.
Yeah, especially if you're an author.
Particularly if you're an author, and particularly if you all come down and have a cigar and have a drink and get a book.
Exactly. Can't beat that. We'll see you next week. Thanks for joining us, folks. Have a great week.